So I'm Carrie, I'm an alcoholic. Okay, so I think we've covered inventory very thoroughly.
Now it's time for our teddy bear.
Audit.
Yeah.
Audit.
So I guess when we talk about it, we talk about the fifth step. What's the value we find in the fifth step process?
Somebody
else has secrets.
Honesty. Somebody knows our secrets.
Somebody can help us see a different perspective.
A negative shared is half.
True.
That's basic human behavior.
True.
And you share your worst thoughts and your worst behaviors and so forth. The feelings therefore are out of hand.
True. Do you realize, you ever think about the way that, you know, again, going back to how the big book is structured, how it works includes, you know, essentially the third and the fourth step, right? And then into action is the fifth step. Why didn't Bill include the fifth step into how it works in writing in with that fourth step? Why do you think he opted to make another chapter? Why do you think that the action part, the real action that occurs or into action starts with step five? Because I can write a fourth step and I can hide it in my trunk.
Yeah. Doesn't become real until it's exposed and brought out into the light.
That's exactly it. Doesn't become real until it's exposed and brought into light. And I'm interacting. Absolutely. So I can write a four step and I can write as many inventories as I want, but if I don't share it, I just basically wrote a bunch of stuff on a piece of paper.
You're Catholic. Examination of conscience.
Sure.
So what?
Exactly. No, I wrote my first fifth step I did when I was 17 years old. I wrote an IKEA inventory. What that means is I wrote a three-column inventory because I looked at the picture. Who the a-hole was, what the a-hole did, and how the a-hole affected me. Then I went to the local priest, and I read this inventory. And he asked me if I wanted to be absolved from my sins, and I said, no, I just wanted to tell you it, and then I left. I got drunk shortly thereafter. Want to hear an amends story?
Oh, yeah.
So I go back and make amends to him because I realized that, you know, I walked into his confessional. He is a priest, he's clergy. I walk in under the idea or under the concept that I was looking for absolution and spiritual guidance, and what I really wanted to do was to use him as a human toilet bowl. So I go in and I sit with him and I do a real inventory with him and a real fifth step. And he ends up doing my pre-cana and he ends up marrying me, my husband.
Aww.
It's a Catholic thing where we get kind of guidance. It's like marriage class by clergy, which is weird because they never get married.
And there's nothing wrong with that picture.
Well, you know, but on the whole of it, when we talk about, like, things that come full circle, so here's this priest that I use as a human toilet bowl that I eventually married me and my husband. Think about that. That's how God's universe works. You know, this is how this process works. This is what we do. You know, so solitary self-appraisal seldom is sufficient, right? Now, it tells us, and Bill, there's only two places that Bill really says, if you don't do this, you're going to drink and die. And one of them is in the fifth step. Because that's where we balk, man. That's where, like, you know, it's like, I can know my dirty secrets, I can even write them down and hide them in the truck of my car under my spare tire. But it's, I sit in eyeball to eyeball with another human being, and sharing that stuff gets kind of scary. But as you do it, and the more you do it, like I don't know, like, if you become an old war horse like me, I can do a fist step, like, I love it. I mean, I think it's like whatever. It's like my daily constitutional, man. You know? And it really is. Like, it's like, I'll tell you a couple fist step stories, because, you know, I told you that, like, my nickname in my home group was Special K, because I'm really special. I thought they were being really nice. I was like, oh, like, after the, well, after a lot of things, but we're going to say it's after the cereal. And I think they meant it because, like, they were, like, because I'm so special. Because I think I'm so special. So anyway, I did this inventory, and I wanted a new experience with the fifth step, so my sponsor directed me. At one point, I was about 6 or 7 years sober to read inventory to 5 women at the same time, all who had completed amends but had less than 2 years of sobriety. Because you know those people, we love them. They think those sponsees, those people, they make people like me who sometimes get tired, enthusiastic, because they're on fire. And God is working in their lives, and they're seeing God, and God is showing up, and God is showing up in these incredible ways, and they're just like enthusiastic, and it's new, and they're exploring, and they're learning things, and they're growing, they're like, I can do this, and these things are happening, and look at this, and look what I learned, and they're just, it's precious. And I'm an ungrateful little shit that sometimes forgets how awesome it is to just be breathing. Right? And so these beautiful, on fire people, you know, like, kindle my spirit. But they also, when you're reading inventory to them, they're like, damn, you still do that? That didn't get fixed? It's very humbling. And so I sat in this diner. It was actually in Summit, New Jersey. It was after this meeting. We all sat there, and I read this inventory. And like, all I wanted to say is, when you're 7 years crazy, when you're 7 years sober, you'll be this crazy too. And they kept going, but the big book says, the 12 and 12 says, Bill Wilson says, Mark H. says, that's not what it says. Why aren't you doing what it says? And I'm like, because it's really hard and I'm lazy and selfish. And sometimes, you know, because we rest on our laurels, you know. And I did that inventory, and it was a hard inventory because, like, they're pointing stuff out and they're on fire. And don't forget, half of them I've heard their fist up, and yet half of them I brought through their own inventory. And 3 out of the 5 women I sponsored, and the other 2 were sponsored by the women that I sponsored. So I had my grand sponsees and my sponsees. They had stuff. They were like, you know what? 6 months ago when I called you on this 10-step thing, and you told me, and then you did it, can you consider that you're a hypocrite? Yes. I can consider that I'm a hypocrite. Right? But the humility in that, the freedom I got from that, because it was still like, this is my 4-step and it's very precious, and this is my 5th step, and I'm only going to tell people who understand, because I don't want you to think less than. And so I'm sitting in this diner with a gaggle of girls who were like, I can pay Carrie back for every time she told me to pray. Every time she told me to write inventory, every time she told me to pray. Because my sponsor had this deal that was, if you call up and you start going into your drama du jour, you got 1 question. Did you write inventory? 2nd question, did you take it to God? And if you answered no to either one of those questions, you heard a dial tone. Because my sponsor really believed that, you know, that reliance and dependence upon a human being didn't help. Basically, by listening to me go through my stuff, it enables me to stay in the problem rather than in the solution. And so my sponsor firmly believed that. So when you kind of have a sponsor who hangs up on you if you haven't written the inventory or prayed on it, you kind of tend to do that, right? Because it's going to be cool like your sponsor. So these are some of the girls that would get that. Did you pray on it? Did you write inventory on it? No? Call me. I didn't hang up. I was at least nice to say, call me back when you do. Click. So they tore into me like a pack of hyenas. And I had a white light spiritual experience as a result of that step, as a result of that 5th step. I drove home from the diner, and I'm twitching. It's like 2:00 in the morning. You know, I read this piece, bit of inventory. I read, you know, all 3 inventories in my ideal. And I got home, and I was like, it was about 45 minutes from my house. And I knew I was really, really tired, but I also knew this, and this is something that we cheat ourselves, that quiet hour after the 5th step. You know, we're like, I'm tired, I'll do it tomorrow, right? But it doesn't have the same impact as that raw vulnerability of having just taking your guts out, putting them on the table, and let people stir around in them, right? You know, you start, your ego already starts to rebuild by the point you, by the time you sat down and did your quiet hour because you were too tired to do it. And I knew that. So I figured my self-preservation instincts would come in, so I took the quiet hour in the tub. Because I figured I would, I needed that hour. I needed to do that because I really believed in that. But I also knew that if I just sat quietly, I probably would fall asleep. So I went in the tub. I figured, like, well, at least I'll start drowning if I fall asleep or something. And I remember, you know, taking out my inventory, and I remember looking at it, and I asked myself those questions. You know, those questions, that construction metaphor, there are two themes that go throughout the book, with one of which is faith without works is dead. Bill repeats that over and over again. The second is this construction metaphor, in which we sit and ask ourselves, like, hey, and essentially what I'm asking myself is, how did I do with the first five steps? Did I leave anything out? Is there anything that I missed? Is there anything I need to take a look at? Do I have any agnosticisms? Or do I have anything that I've withheld in terms of my understanding of steps 1 through 5? And you take that quiet time. You know, and what I was taught to do was to take that inventory that you just read between you, God, and another human being, and sit with it with God. To look it over. To really ask myself, like, hey, did I miss anything? Is there anything I need to see in this, God? Is there something else that I need to be made aware of? And really take that hour. So I took that hour, and something happened. Like, I needed to put pen to paper again. And I thought it was because there was a piece of inventory that I missed. And I just started writing. And I started writing about how powerless I felt to know what living on a spiritual basis looked like, but how I kept failing to show up that way in my life. And how grieved I felt about that. How grieved I felt about the fact that, you know, I can know in my heart and believe in this program with all my heart and love God with every fiber of my being, yet there are times that I absolutely fall asleep to that fact and I do things that are not in line with what I know to be true for myself. And how sad that makes me that I can fall asleep to that fact and get so disconnected without any real warning. Well, I mean, there's plenty of warning, but I'm not catching it, you know? And about how much I dearly wanted God to be a part of everything that I was and everything that I did. Like, I felt an incredible thirst, a hunger, a spiritual hunger that I don't think I've ever felt in my life before. And so I started writing. And I wrote this article. It was called From the Head to the Heart. And, I mean, somebody named it. I just wrote it, and then I actually gave it to a spiritual advisor and said, I don't know what the hell this is. Can you take a look at it? And he stole it, and it's just been everywhere. And that's kind of actually how I started doing stuff like this, is I wrote that, and somebody was like, this is incredible. Can you come and give a talk on this? And, you know, that was, I was 7 years sober. 13 years later, my butt sitting in a chair doing a conference that some of the people that have saved my life and changed me on a fundamental level have sat, and some of these people are in this room. That's an incredible thing to me. But it was because of that experience, because somebody said, hey, why don't you try this? Do a multiple fist step. What are you afraid of? Try doing it with somebody who has less time than you. Try doing it with somebody where you're not going to explain or defend. You're simply going to be there and be fallible and be open and be vulnerable. And let them see every ugly part of you. And stand in God's grace anyway. And it was a truly beautiful thing. And what came to me was there's in We Agnostics, it says that, and I'll kind of walk you through this a little bit. On page, and this is what came to me in that quiet time. It said on page 44. So it says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. We found that such codes and philosophies did not save us. No matter how much we tried, we could wish to be moral, we could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might. But the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Lack of power is our dilemma. We had to find the power by which we can live, and it has to be a power greater than ourselves. obviously, but how and where we find this power. So I'm sitting in the bathtub doing this quiet hour, and this paragraph in the big book comes alive for me. And I say, that's what's going on here, man. I'm writing this inventory at 7 years, having worked the steps for 5 years, you know, back to back, doing inventory, doing the deal, in the firing lines, carrying this message. But there's a disconnect here. There's a blockage, and I don't even know what it is, and I'm so powerless over it that I wake up and realize that I'm on autopilot, and I don't know how I got here. And that power to fix that disconnect wasn't in me. And it wasn't something I could do on my own. And I finally realized on a deep, deep fundamental level that when I'm writing this inventory, when I'm sitting there making that amends, or when I'm doing my med review, when I'm sitting here doing this deal and carrying this message, that the thing, that spiritual malady that we talk about, that thing that operates inside of me is exactly this. I can know what the right thing is to do, but somewhere between what I know and what I on my own power can produce, it gets distorted. And that conduit, although I know it, and I know that it's distorted, there are times when I believe that it's not. But it is. And that's not a kink or a distortion that I can fix. And it's something that I have no power to change except for allow the change to occur. And it's a matter of allowing and surrendering and being moved rather than demanding and shaping on my own ideas and thoughts. Because I kept saying, well, God, if you fix me, I'll stop being so resentful. You know, it's God's fault my character defects haven't been removed. I asked, he just ain't doing it. You ever say that? I've been asking for God, I've been working on this. We say it all the time. I told you I was working on my language. Not really working on my language. I'm just aware that it prevents me from being effective in my life. On some level, my language helps because it makes me approachable. On another level, it pushes people away because it makes me unapproachable. So instead, I ask God to take care of the job, and I open my mouth, and most of the time, I land in that nice little place where I can make a penis joke and still be approachable. I kind of like that, because I'm a naughty girl, and I'm okay with that. But if I showed up here and I was Snow White and I had all the little chirping birdies and I told you how wonderful I was and I was pristine and awesome, the guys would be bored and the women would stab me with all kinds of implements when I wasn't looking. You know? So this paragraph became, it was like imprinted in my soul, and I understood it on a level that I don't think I understood up until that point. And so then the other references to it, the references that we see in how it works when it talks on page 62, that, you know, so our troubles are our own making. I begin to truly understand what that was because I felt it. And more than anything else, what I felt was that it wasn't something that I was going to do that was going to change this. It was something that I was going to allow. And I'll explain that to you. When it's something I do, there's an action I take, and I have some level of responsibility or some level of expectation and outcome. So when I said, you know, a lot of times we do the work to not do the work, meaning that I do this work because I want to be something, or I think that there's some sort of outcome or some sort of goal that we're supposed to achieve from doing this work. So I set that out in my mind, and I say that I don't have it, but I really do. And then I do this work and I completely miss the point, which is a surrender. And a surrender, not in a surrender like, you know, you surrender to win. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about that attitude that we take in the third step. When we say, you're my director. You are the principal, I am your agent. You are the father, I am your child. When we say the word, my maker, my creator, this is what we're talking about. We're talking about a surrender that is not on the intellectual level, but a surrender that's on the spirit of the soul, where we recognize and we truly understand, and we understand it with the deepest parts of us, that I am not my own maker, and I am not my own creator, and that I have very little to do with the person who's sitting here today. And very little to do with the person who's sitting here today. I have very little to do with the woman I've become. I've simply shown up. And I kind of look at it like the Grand Canyon. You know, there were some rocks and there was a river. The river did what it did and the rocks did what it did. And we have this beautiful, spectacular, incredible thing that anybody who looks at it feels awe. And feels magnificent, and feels small and huge and connected at the same time. When you look at that, there's just something about it that makes you feel as if this world is a beautiful, wonderful place, isn't it? You just think about it and you feel that way. I am the rock and God is the river. And this is what this process does. God uses this process. God is the river, and I am a rock. The rock isn't doing anything but being the rock. The rock shows up as the rock. The river shows up as the river. If the river thought that it had any control over the rock, and the rock thought it had any control over the river, we'd have the Hoover Dam. Right? Because that's what that is, right? We got the rock in the river, man-made, got a dam, beautiful Lake Mead, people in Lake Vegas have water, Bob Darrell is now taking a shower because of the Hoover Dam. We're all good with that. But what I'm talking about is the allowing, the not demanding, the not controlling, the simply being, and allowing God in this process to do what it does. And accepting whatever the outcome of that situation is. That's something I didn't understand until that moment. That what I thought I knew about what this process was not what this process was at all. But I was still looking for an outcome. I was still looking to manage well. And in a deep level, and I had this moment, and I had this thirst and this want for God. And I literally, naked, got down on my knees, got out of the tub, got down on my knees and begged. And just said, God, I just want you. I just want you. I don't ever. I need you in every aspect of who I am. Because without you, no matter how I show up, I still show up now. And I need that. And I had this moment where I truly wanted all of God and all of me. And it was a beautiful thing. And I was never the same again. And I know I was never the same. Because I went to the DMV in New Jersey 3 days later and I was not angry. And I thanked people and stuff. And it was really nice and it was July and I was there with two kids. And I'm like, thank you, that's so nice. And I just walked out and I realized, and I looked around and I had this profound thing and I was like, okay, this is kind of cool, right? Like, I didn't get it. Cause like, you really don't get that stuff until after, right? Like, you have this thing, I'm naked, I'm praying, and I'm like, God, this is weird. I'm seeing myself do it naked on the floor of my bathroom, begging God. Now that's happened before, naked on the floor of my bathroom, begging God for something. Right? In that moment, you know? And I was like, okay, that's kind of weird. I'm not really going to tell anybody about that. I don't think actually I've told anybody that that moment was when I was naked until today. I don't think I actually included that detail. I have no idea why I just did that. But anyway, it was. It really is true. I just think I left that out. for propriety. I don't know. I mean, told you I prostituted for booze, but it's not okay to beg God naked. I don't know. It's okay to beg for booze naked, apparently. Anyway.
Nothing he hadn't seen before.
True. Absolutely true. But anyway. So, you know, I didn't even think much about it. I had this thing. It was kind of like, that was weird. I'm not really going to talk about it, right? So I kind of tell my husband a little bit. I leave out some details, and he's just like, that's weird, right? And then they go to the DMV, and I walk out smiling in the July sunshine, having sweaty and disgusting with screaming children, thinking, I really have a good life. This is awesome. I can't believe that. And I, oh, by the way, and I didn't get anything done either. Like, they were like, wrong line, wrong paper, wrong everything.
Yeah, oh yeah.
You know? And so I walk out of there after having spent 4 or 5 hours in a sweat, standing in line with 2 children in July, happy. I'm like, what the hell just happened? And I realize, I'm like, I better not tell anybody about this because it'll go away. but it started to filter through. And that experience in itself, like, really sustained me for about 2 years. You know, in terms of, like, sometimes we have those experiences that are so sudden and profound that rearrange so much of who you are that, like, you know, for, you know, years afterwards, they are just... They inform, you know, pretty much everything you do. You know, so that was a profound experience I had as a result of the fifth step. And it happened because I had an open mind and I was willing to do what was suggested to me. In the same way, I was willing to drink whatever you told me to drink. And I was willing to do whatever you told me to do to get your acceptance, approval, and love. But sometimes that willingness, you tell me to do this or write that or do this, and I say, nope. Nah. That's inconvenient, you know. So when I ask you to come to this step, and I say that this is a step that definitely, the process that occurs from that fifth step until you're knocking on doors with the ninth step, which is, by the way, how long between the fifth step, the end of your fifth step, and your ninth step? How long does that take?
A couple days.
Quiet hour. Hit your knees. You got a list from your A step. Shit, if your sponsor doesn't leave your house or you don't leave your sponsor's house, you could be done in a matter of an hour and a half. What are your thoughts on that, Gary?
Done with just the fifth step?
I said from the end of the fifth step till you start knocking on doors, making amends. How long is that?
I'm going to throw a curve at you. Yeah, you get your inventory from your debt. What about those amends you owe that didn't make her?
What ones might those be? The ones that we missed because it didn't show up? What about them?
There wasn't any resentment, there wasn't any we felt feelings about them, but I had stolen from people, I borrowed money from parents and in-laws, and that sort of thing, deceitfully.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't angry with them, they didn't show up on my resentment list.
But that's why we have that conduct inventory.
Huh?
That's why we have the conduct inventory. Those are the people we didn't sleep with and we didn't resent, but we still screwed over.
That was well before I heard about the conduct inventory not being anything but screwing around.
Now, Tim, and you're right, though, that when you make your A-step list, there will be stuff that comes up, absolutely. That's part of why we do the quiet hour. You know, because there will be things that come up while you're sitting in that quiet hour that you missed. Absolutely. But in terms of a time frame, from the time that you finish your quiet hour and you start knocking on the doors, if you take that quiet hour and you hit your knees after that quiet hour and do your 6th and 7th step, which takes all of 5 minutes because you've been working the 6th and 7th step since step 1, all that is a reconfirmation of what you knew when you started this process, which is you're broken and you can't fix you. That's 6 and 7, man.
About a minute, man.
Yeah. And you can go start knocking on some doors.
My sponsor insisted that before I go out and start knocking doors, that I do 3x5 index cards.
Yes.
And we go over them because I wasn't always ready to go out on my own and start making amends.
True. And you're absolutely right on that. The first handful of times of bringing people through the steps, I have them do 3x5 cards. What I have them do is, I don't make them, and this is the thing, I don't make you go over all of them all at once, because you know what? We're all procrastinating pains in the ass. I tell you to take 5. We do 5 at a time. You give me 5 amends you're going to start with, go out and do them. So that's something I can do right after that quiet hour, because I don't leave. You take your quiet hour and I take a quiet hour, because I just heard a bunch of duties. And I need to clear my decks as much as you need to clear your decks. Plus, probably listening to your inventory has brought up some things that maybe I need to look at myself. So maybe there's some inventory I need to be writing. So I take that quiet hour just like you do. So you take your quiet hour, I take mine. And then we take 6 and 7 together. Take five harms from your inventory. Put them on a card. Take 5 cards. Go start knocking on some doors. That's my thing.
So do you do fifth steps at like 8 o'clock in the morning? Because my fifth step was a lingering, long, drawn-out process. And it was like 10 p.m. at the time.
Yeah.
We called back and did the seventh step prayer.
Yeah. There are times, and I've done them multiple ways. I've done them where we've done marathons. I've had people come to my house on a Friday, leave on a Sunday on their amends. Absolutely. There are times I have done, especially with people when it's their first time through inventory, I have them write their inventory, I have them write their first and second columns, and I help them write their third and fourth. Because they're going to lie anyway. Seriously. No offense, but like, you know, my idea of selfishness and a newcomer's idea of selfishness is very different. So I figure rather than have them spend all that time writing something to just rewrite it, write it with me. So I have them write their first and second column. I have them come with first and second column done. We do their third and fourth column together. You're writing your third and fourth, you're reading your third and fourth column with me or writing it. We start your fear inventory. You come back 2 days later, you read that piece of inventory. You come back 2 days later, you read your sex inventory or your conduct inventory. We have a list of amends. You do your quiet hour. We add more amends that come up from the quiet hour. Then we got this 8-step list. We got it from writing inventory. We put them on 3x5 cards, and we get rocking and rolling. I try to make it pretty easy for somebody who's new to do this because we make a big deal about nothing, you know, and the amends are so scary, and this stuff's so scary, and everything's so scary. So I try to make it easy on them because, you know, the truth is God doesn't make too hard with the terms with those who seek him. You know, but if you've been through inventory process and you're still balking, we need to take a look at them. But yeah, like I hold their hand. So sometimes it takes me a whole week to get through a fifth step with somebody because I'll do multiple appointments. Sometimes if you've been through inventory before and you have it all written out, we'll go wham bam, thank you, ma'am. We'll do a 12-hour deal. Sometimes you'll come and I'll say, okay, look, man, bring an overnight bag. We'll do it Friday night, we'll go to sleep, wake up in the morning, do it. Because the idea is I don't want to give you time between your fifth step and your 8-step and 9-step. Because that's when, like, you know, you start negotiating. Right? You start, the plus and minus, I hate that. When people put the plus and minus on their, I'm willing to make it this one, but I'm not that one. Put a bottle next to your big book and ask yourself which is easier, die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. We're not plusing, minusing. We're not triaging. That's called playing God. You know, we've kind of, the whole point of this process is to allow this process to be what it is. You know, so when I start plusing, minusing, and negotiating with the 12 steps, I got a problem. So I don't do that. But I do make it so that when you stare at 90 amends and you stare at 5 amends, it's a lot easier to do the 5 than the 90. So I have you do 5 at a time. You know, that to me seems to work in terms of a newcomer. You know, because like I said, five amends, and the commitment is to make two amends a week. There's no sitting on an amends for a month. If you got that card and you got that marching orders, you're not sitting on it for a month unless you can't get a hold of somebody, something like that. But I mean, like in terms of first approach, the commitment is two amends a week. That's a pretty reasonable thing for a busy person. I can make that time. I made an amends on my way here in the airport. There was somebody who was a newcomer, who was one of my husband's sponsees, and I'm charming, and he developed a little bit of a crush on me. That's never happened to me before. He had about 2 years, and he developed a little bit of a crush on me, and I didn't realize it. and I was insensitive and inconsiderate because I kind of just think, you know, he made me, I don't know, we were having fun and we went to meetings, we did this stuff, and I didn't realize that his feelings for me were deeper than what I had expected or what I had evaluated. And then all of a sudden, one day he professed his undying love to me. And I had to cut him off, you know, because that's what we do. Lovingly, I had to say, you know, like, I'm sorry, but, you know, I'm sorry if I gave you the, you know, that talk. But upon inventory, I realized, like, wait a minute, like, I should have picked that up and I didn't. And there was a part of me that didn't want to because I liked him. He was my friend and I didn't want to lose him. And I enjoyed his company. And he had a couple years, so I was like, you know, he has a couple years. It's okay. But the fact is I was selfish. I knew he was partial to me. I just really liked him as a human being, and I knew that if I did the right thing, that meant that I was going to have to lose my friendship with him, and I chose my friendship with him over his emotional and spiritual security. And as a result, I caused him harm. So the weirdest thing happened was that he friended me on Facebook, and it happened to be his birthday on Friday. And his thing popped up. I didn't even know he was my friend. Like, I don't know how it happened, but like I must have been just hit accept, 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 accept. And all of a sudden, this person's face pops up. It's so-and-so's birthday. And I said, holy shit. I owe that person an amends. I made a quick phone call. I got clear about my harm. I contacted him. I said, can I have a few minutes of your time? And I said, look, I'm on my way to Indianapolis. I owe you an amends. Is there a time in which you and I can have a conversation in public? I'm not stupid. Or a way that I can have a conversation with you because there, you know, there's an amends that I owe you. You know, I treated you in a way that was, you know, that was unbecoming of a spiritual woman. And he was so grateful. It took 3 minutes to set up that amends. That amends will be made, God willing, by the end of the week. Wasn't that hard to do? So, I mean, we make a big deal about stuff because we make a big deal about stuff because the fact is I don't like admitting to things that I didn't get caught for. I don't like looking bad. I don't like being humble. But I'll tell you what, I like being free. And I like the fact that I can be in the airport. I mean, I was in Carolina, actually. I can be in Charlotte, and I can see somebody's name on my phone, and I can, in that moment, have complete and utter willingness to set right the wrong harms that I caused, and be willing to go to someone and say, hey, look, this is what I think I did. This is the situation. I wrote out, I keep index cards with me, by the way, because that's where I write inventory. Those are how I do my little 10 steps. And I wrote a quick inventory. I had already written inventory on this guy and I couldn't find him. And so I had wrote that. I didn't have it on me. I wrote a quick inventory. I picked up my phone. I spoke to another alcoholic. I got clear on my harm, contacted him, asked him for permission to have a conversation with him. I did it in 8 minutes. I timed it. Took me 8 minutes to do that. God doesn't make too hard terms with those who seek him. The only people who make this process hard is us. So a fifth step.
But we don't make amends by reading them off a card.
No! Yes, thank you! No! Good clarification. No! Yeah.
And my experience is very much with sensitive ones. I mean, you know, Shell Oil Company is one thing.
Mm-hmm.
A teenager child is another thing, and some of those I consider my biggest function as a sponsor to role play those.
Yes.
In some cases, to get angry in your face,
mm-hmm.
tug on you a little bit so you don't come unraveled.
Yes.
In front of your kid and what else is going on.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's where my sponsor really earns his pay is with my eight-step list.
Yes.
Because my solitary self-appraisal on the eight-step list was insufficient in my experience, yeah.
Absolutely. Before we kind of move on to 6, 7, 8, 9, because that again is pretty, it's a block. Does anybody have any other questions or any concerns about the fifth step? Anything that any ideas or concepts about it that maybe you need clarification with or experience that can be done in all kinds of ways, in all kinds of places? It can be.
Can you comment on the words of the step or the fifth to God? To ourselves and another person. Mm-hmm. Why is that there?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that my experience with that and my understanding of it is this, is that when you and I come together, God's in that room. Mm-hmm. But I fall asleep to the fact that God's there. I fall asleep to God's wherever I am. I fall asleep to that fact all the time. So when I'm looking at it and I'm looking at the step and I'm sitting, not only am I admitting to another person and to myself, but also to God, I'm reminding myself to the fact that God is a part of this process and a part of what I'm doing. And it is the thing that brings us together. Now, I have actually done it where we've taken that literally. So I've done a fifth step and then I went home and read the inventory aloud to myself and God in quiet time meditation as part of the quiet hour. So, you know, I've gone and say, okay, I have 5 or 6 resentments, some fears, and some conduct inventory. I'm going to go read it to Carrie. We do a fifth step. And then I go home, and as part of the quiet hour, I actually sit, and I read that piece of inventory aloud with God, with in prayer and meditation, and experience it with me and God. Because sometimes we forget that it isn't just the sponsor or the person, the receptacle, that's hearing the fifth step. But the real power in that room is not you, and it's not me. It's God. So I think that it's in there to remind us of that fact, that this is not a confession just to my sponsor or to the person receiving the fifth step, but this is a confession to my innermost self. Because where does God exist? That God, deep down inside of every man, woman, and child, is a fundamental idea of God. He might be obscured, right? But he's there. How do we find it? What does we agnostics tell us how we find out what we really believe about God? We search fearlessly. How do we search fearlessly? Well, we do a fearless and thorough inventory. So literally the book tells us that if I do a fearless and thorough inventory, the fundamental ideas about God that I have deep down inside of me will become clear to me. That the problem isn't that they're not there, is that they're obscured by the things that are in my inventory. So the fifth step process, and the reason why we say to admit it to ourselves, to another human being, and to God, is because those are the three important features in that process. And it reminds us that without any one of them, the fifth step isn't a fifth step. It's me walking into the confessional saying to the priest, no, I don't want forgiveness. I just wanted to tell you, thank you very much, and leaving. You kind of get what I'm saying? So you can do that, and I found it to be really useful. You kind of feel weird, though, because you're talking to yourself. Like, you're reading your inventory out loud to yourself. And if you're kind of self-conscious, like, it feels kind of funny. But I think there's definitely a humility about it. You know, like, I talk to myself all the time, but of course reading inventory to myself and to God, it's an interesting prospect. I've done it a couple times and I thought, okay, I did that, check it off the list. I didn't have a profound, earth-shattering experience with it. It's okay. I didn't die. I didn't drink. And I certainly grew from it. So I figured, what the heck? It's worth a shot. Some people have found it to be incredibly profound. I didn't. It was. But I look at it like this. It's like any spiritual experience is a good experience. It may not feel like that at the time, but it pretty much always is. Any other questions about the fifth step? Okay. So 6 and 7 takes about a minute, right? It's a deep concept, and the way that I explain it to people, and they ask me how you work 6 and 7, I say 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. because that's really the truth of it. You don't work 6 and 7.
Either there or you're not. Yeah. You either stay there or you're not.
Yeah. But the idea is that spirituality through subtraction occurs. 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. So those things that I saw that were objectionable to me on my inventory and through my fifth step are the things that are being removed or being weeded from my garden through the amends process, through the 10-step process, through prayer and meditation, and through carrying this message to other people. So the reality is that 6 and 7 is the bookend to the contract that I made with God at step 3, and it's a confirmation of what I know. But it's also like, well, when I took my third step, I took my third step somewhat blindly, right? So I didn't really know what my will in my life was. I just knew that the things that I was doing, the end results of this was kind of sucky, right? But now I know what that looks like. I know how that's showing up. I have it on paper. I've shared it with other human beings. I sat with God with it. I sat in all the glory of my stupidity, all the glory of my character defects, all the glory of my selfishness, all the glory of my resentment, all the glory of my fear. And I sat and I felt that. I felt the powerlessness of that. I felt the deep hurt, because we're not bad people. We're not. And when we do things that don't honor our spirit, we truly feel it deep inside of us. We do. There's not a person here that doesn't feel it. We call it something else. We might spin a story about it. But deep down inside, we feel that. We know it. It's intrinsic. We call it a conscience. We call it God consciousness, a vital sixth sense. We have it. Right? So when I'm doing this and I'm sitting in this stuff, I'm feeling that disconnect between what I know to be right and what's showing up in my life. And I'm feeling that true powerlessness, because I know I'm doing things that I know I shouldn't be doing, and I don't know how not to do it, right? And I'm feeling that sense of, man, you know, my relationships, everything, like that, like kind of like I have a minus touch in reverse, right? And it's not because I'm so broken, but because even in my best moments, I'm a producer of confusion rather than harmony, right? I'm living by self-propulsion, because I know that I have this idea of who Carrie's supposed to be. But because I'm trying to make Carrie, I'm not allowing God to do it. So we come to this and we have some questions. It says, are we now ready to have God remove all these things from us which we admitted are objectionable? But here's the deal. If you wait until the next day or, you know, a week till you do your quiet hour, and after you look at your inventory and you sit with those feelings, sometimes we start to rationalize the things that we found objectionable in the process of the fifth step. You ever do that? Start negotiating with it, and you think, it's not that bad. Yeah. It was a white lie. I meant well. I don't really have to make that amends. They don't belong on my 8-step list. We start editing and negotiating. So that's why it's important that when we do this, when we sit with this, we do it right after this raw fifth step thing. We're in this process because, you know, I'm a sick human being and I can rationalize playing with the turd if I want to. And I really don't want to give myself the opportunity to do something like that. So there's that question, is, are they objectionable? Remember, we started out saying that we're looking for damaged and unsaleable goods, right? If I fool myself about the values of the things that I have in my inventory, I'm not going to admit that they're objectionable, am I? If I still think there's value in my old ideas, then I stay stuck. So it's in admitting that these things are objectionable and truly looking at them and saying, is this really who I want to be? Is this how I want to show up in this world? Is this really me living and God's grace and God's love? Am I really showing up with that third step? I made a deal with God. I'm now an orange frog. How's that working out for me? And we need to ask ourselves and say, you know, is it objectionable? I'll tell you something that I didn't think was objectionable. Sarcasm. I thought it made me cute. I thought I was adorable. Until I realized how much harm I caused with my sarcasm. That having a conversation with me was like having a conversation with Freddy Krueger. Sarcasm means to cut. And I cut.
Anger's ugly cousin.
Yeah. And so for me, I thought sarcasm was not objectionable until I saw the impact it had on the people in my life. Until I had it in black and white, and it was in front of me. And then I shared it with you, and I shared it with God. And I felt the pain that one feels when you hurt people that you love. And it's supposed to be uncomfortable. If it was comfortable, we wouldn't... Pain is a great motivator, guys. As alcoholics, we're avoidant of pain because, you know, it's kind of how we're wired. There's nothing wrong with feeling uncomfortable about having done things that hurt people that you care about. Because, frankly, it's that discomfort and sitting in that discomfort and facing that discomfort and being willing to set right those harms that change us on an intrinsic level. You know, because most of the time, the things that we do that hurt other people are us avoiding pain to begin with. I don't want to be uncomfortable. I don't want to feel bad about myself. I don't want to feel small. I don't want to feel powerless. I don't want to. So I'm going to take this action with the motive that I'm fixing something that I really have no business fixing in the first place because I don't want to feel what I'm feeling. And we do that all the time. So feeling discomfort of facing those feelings, those actions, those behaviors, how that's harming other people, that's a necessary part of this process. And it also hardens us. We need to be hardened to discomfort. We do. We're not made of glass. I'm not going to cry like a little girl because I feel bad or think I don't like this and I don't like that. If I live in fear of emotional pain, then I'm giving power to fear. And fear of emotional pain, guys, we'll handle physical pain. You could take a sledgehammer to my foot, and I'll be like, see, look how tough I am. I didn't even take any, you know, I didn't even take any painkillers. And then you tell me I'm fat, and I cry in the corner. Because emotional pain is what I'm truly afraid of. And it goes back to those fears and that unworthiness. The only way around this, the only way through this, or the only way around it is through, meaning that fear and faith can exist, but I can't worship fear and worship God. I gotta choose. I can walk through fear by carrying and honoring faith. But if I make fear my master and I fear emotional discomfort, I will never truly be free. I will never truly be free. Because I will always try to avoid things that bring up feelings that make me feel icky. And therefore, I always give power to my emotions. My fear of my emotions will always rule me. And I will stay trapped. And I'll be a shivering denizen of King, instead of King Alcohol, King Fear. So we really have to sit with that. Is that objectionable to me? How's that working? I got lots of inventory that tells me the things that show up on my inventory, it's not working for me. And I have to admit that, and I have to sit with that. Now, we don't have to sit long. That's why it's called an hour, you know. But we have to be willing to face that. And it says, can he now take them, everyone? Now, it doesn't say will he. He says can, because what it's asking us more than anything else is, do I have a higher power that's a higher power? Or do I have a higher power that I still believe is limited? Now, if I have a higher power that will not or cannot take these, then I don't have a higher power that works, and it's not a power greater than myself. and is not a power sufficient to produce the results that I need in order to recover. And I'll kind of give you an example, and I'll kind of start wrapping it up because it's getting late. And I'm sure you all have to pee. I had a sponsee once. She was gay. I loved her. She was awesome. She was also a Jehovah's Witness. And Jehovah's Witnesses, they're like really not with the gay at all. And she was like this beautiful girl. And so every time she was gay, she would drink. Because she believed that God was going to make her go to hell because she was gay. Now, I'm not arguing whether or not the origins gay, that sort of stuff. That's not what we're talking about here. But I asked her in this inventory process and her fear inventory, and this fear came up. And I asked her, I said, well, how long have you been trying not to be gay? And she's like, well, since I've known you, I was gay. And I said, well, when was that? She was like, since I was 12. I'm like, well, you're 24 years old. So for the past 12 years, you tried not to be gay. How's that working? She's like, not very well, Carrie. I said, well, can you consider that you may not be able to change the fact that you're gay at this moment, but you know what? You can change what you believe about God. That is in your power. Can you consider that maybe what you need here is not to change the fact that you're gay, but maybe believe that God loves you no matter what you are? And she looked at me like I was completely insane. And I asked her, I said, I just want you to consider this, just sit with this. Because it comes back to this question. Can he? If your God doesn't like you and you don't like him, get a new God. If your God is so mean that he's going to leave character defects just to torture you, or you think, get a new God. Because my experience has been I have to have a God that I believe can remove my character defects, that can remove the things that are objectionable, that can shape me. In his time, not mine. I told you, I'm the rock, he is the water. The Grand Canyon will happen. It's a process. It's always a process. The results are not in my hands. But if I say to myself that water's not powerful enough to change that rock, then I'm limiting the water and therefore it's not going to occur. So I'm blocking it before it can even happen. So I asked her that. She drank a couple more times. She decided to change the way, she didn't change her religion. She simply accepted the fact that maybe, just maybe, God didn't hate her for being gay. She's happily in a relationship, and she's happily married, and she's happily gay, and she still goes to temple, and it was something she had to resolve within herself. She had to believe that a power could, and that God loved her enough too. And when that happened inside of her, what other people told her about God didn't matter. So when we talk about this seven step, and we ask these questions, the sixth step, and we say, can he? What we're really asking is your God bigger than your character defects? Is your God bigger than your alcoholism? And if he's not, you might want to take a look at that. Because if your alcoholism is more powerful than your higher power, then obviously the only higher power that's operating in your life is your alcoholism. Kind of like this, lightning strikes the highest object, right? So if your alcoholism is greater than your belief or your belief in God's power, it's going to be attracted, or the energy is going to be attracted to the highest object, the thing that you give most power to. And if I believe my alcoholism has the most power, that's where I'm going to give power. That's where I'm going to give my attention. That's where I'm going to give my faith. And I stay a prisoner of fear or in the bondage of self. So we say, you know, six and seven, it's a quick process, but there's actually a lot to it. You know, and then we say this prayer and we start with my creator. We started the third step with my maker, our maker, my creator. Take into meditation the words my creator. Take it into the quiet. sit with those words, my creator. It's amazing what happens when you do that. You know, I told you that that was the spiritual term that really just absolutely resonated with my soul. All the other things that were in this book were wonderful, but the my creator thing just hit me. And it hit me in all the right places. And we say, I'm willing you should have all of me, good and bad. I put away the judge. I don't get to decide. I don't know what's good and bad. I'm giving it all. So we inventoried the store, and then we gave the store away is essentially what we did. You know, I looked for the damaged, unsaleable goods. I identified what they are. I put a sticker on them. And then I gave God the keys, right? And I said, okay. I'm hiring a new manager. You have my store. I did my business inventory. I'm hiring you as the manager. I retire. I'll work here. I'll work the checkout line. I'll mop it up. I'll stock the shelves. But you decide what gets to be kept in the inventory. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect that stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. God reduces, he takes away our pride. This takes away our pride. I don't ask God to remove my character defects that make me awesome and a saint. Instead, God removes the character defects that prevents me from being useful to my fellows. We're not supposed to be perfect, shiny, plastic people. God doesn't want that for us, and he never did. Because the fact is this, if I was a shiny, happy, perfect person, I would have no need for God because I would be my own. The beauty in this world isn't the perfection of it, it is the absolute imperfection of it. And until I can internalize that, not only about the external and the trees and the rocks and all of the things about nature and everything that I see that makes this world a beautiful place, that also applies to me. That speaks about my character and my soul. So the world is a beautiful place, and the world is an interesting place, not because of its perfection, but because of its imperfections. One can say that it's perfectly imperfect. So the things that God is removing from me isn't the things that make me carry. And I think that's the biggest fear that people have in this process, that they're going to start this process and they're going to become somebody that they don't like and they don't want to be. And the truth is you will become more of who you are. I am more of who I am and who I was meant to be. I am not the same person who walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, yet I am more that person than I have ever been in my life. Because the worst person who walked into Alcoholics Anonymous was blocked by so many things and was so completely and utterly lost that I didn't even know who I was. And I couldn't see the forest through the trees. This process removes that and allows you to be more of who you are. So there's perfection in our imperfection. And that love and compassion that we have for each other, we have for ourselves. It says, grant me the strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. And we're asking for God's strength because we're about to do some serious bidding. We're about to start knocking on some doors. We're about to start putting our money where our mouth is. You know, the first handful of steps are about me, God, and alcohol. The next handful of steps are about me, God, and you. And the last little bit of steps are about me, God, and you, and putting my feet on the pavement, man. And it's about putting all of that stuff, all of that I've learned and all of the experience that I have, and putting it into practical action. And it's a scary thing. The amends are not an easy thing to do. They're not an easy thing to face. And there's so much that we can talk about in terms of amends. We talked about how to make an eight-step list. I've told you amends stories throughout this talk and throughout the talks this weekend. I would like to go into greater detail in the morning about amends and really have you all share some of your amends experiences. I think it's really important to hear. Because I think that for me, that a greater demonstration of God's healing grace is through my amends. I mean, I can tell you that I didn't see them at the time, and I didn't know that the amends process was intended to do what it does or has done. But the amends process has probably changed me more than anything else. And I'll give an example and then we'll close. Unless you guys want to ask some questions. But I told you that I had a ninth grade education, right? And I told you that, you know, I went to school and I'm in school and I'm an excellent student. One of my sponsors in this process was an educator. So some of the inventory and conduct inventory I wrote was about destroying property, being disrespectful to teachers and this sort of stuff. And I felt like, just like cops, that teachers kind of deserved what they got because they were stupid enough to do that job. That was the old idea that I told myself. And the significant part of this is that my older sister Maureen, the one who like abuses alcohol because she doesn't drink it right, she was 16 when I was born, and the day that I was born, she actually named me. And the day that I was born, she went to high school, and she went to her favorite teacher, which was her homeroom teacher. His name was Mr. Orsini. And she told him about how she had this little sister, Carrie, and about how she named me. Now, my sister Maureen is 16 years older than me, but if I put a picture of her next to me, we look almost exactly alike. That's actually why I wear my hair short, because everybody calls me Maureen. We both have the same green eyes, the same pale skin. Her nose is a little pointier, and she's about a half inch shorter. My boobs are a little bigger, and that's about it. She's also 52 and looks like me, so I kind of hate her because she's really, 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 you know, like at this point, like she doesn't look like she's 52. She looks like she's 32, and she's one of those. But she's beautiful, and she's one of the most wonderful people in the world. So everybody thought I was her illegitimate child, actually, because I was the tumor. I was born when my parents were in their 40s, and my sister was 16, and I looked just like her. So she had this mini-me following around. So the rumor in the neighborhood was that I was my sister's daughter, and that I was her illegitimate child. And it really wasn't true. My mom had me. I'm my mom's kid. You know, she's not my mother's sister, but we had this, me and my sister Maureen had this incredible bond because of that. And because she practically raised me, because she was the only one who wasn't doing drugs and drinking in the house, and she's the only one who thought, maybe we should feed the baby, you know what I mean? So I'm alive today because of her. And more than one reason, because she also did revive me from two overdoses. So anyway, so she goes and tells Mr. Orsini about this beautiful baby sister that she has. Fast forward, I'm 16 years old, and I'm destroying property. And I'm being really disrespectful. I'm physically confronting teachers. I'm doing really terrible things. And every day I get sent to Mr. Orsini's office because he is now the vice principal of discipline. And I would hear your sister Maureen is so beautiful. You look just like her. What's wrong with you? Why can't you be more like your sister? She didn't do these things. And of course, I heard, you're a piece of crap, you're not good enough, all that other stuff. And I would get angry and verbally abusive, and then I would be suspended and thrown out of his office, and eventually I was expelled twice from that school. They expelled me, and a couple years later, some other schools expelled me. They took me back, and then expelled me again. So I'm doing this conduct inventory, and all of this comes up. And my sponsor at the time, who was an educator, said, you owe an amends. I'm like, F no, I don't. They deserve that. They're teachers. If they're stupid enough to do that job, then they're going to be verbally abused, and I don't owe them amends for nothing. Especially not Mr. Orsini, because he said I should be more like my sister. And how dare you tell me the truth? So, anyway, needless to say, she won, I didn't. And I went and made an appointment. I went into Mr. Orsini's office, and I had a written letter to this faculty, explaining who I was, what I was doing. I sat down with him, explained what I was about, agreed to meet with the faculty who was still present in the school at the time. And in this conversation, he's asking me about, you know, well, what are you doing? And I was like, well, you know, I dropped out of school. I don't really have a GED. I really don't have anything going on. And he filed that away. And then when I got to those three questions, because you asked those three questions, right? Is there anything else I did to harm you? Is there anything you need to tell me about what we just talked about, and what could I do to set this right? You know what he told me I had to do? Go to college. But we make this deal, right? I'm an orange frog. I made a deal with God. I hit my knees in the seventh step. I begged God to relieve me of this. I begged God to relieve me of the bondage of self. I begged God to take all of me, good and bad. And now I'm sitting in this guy's office who told me that I wasn't my sister. And he's telling me the only way that I can set right the harms that I caused was to go to college. So I had a choice, die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. I had no choice but face the fear of failure. So I went to college. And it turns out, apparently, when I'm not being violently destructive and I'm not drunk, I'm a great student. And I'm sitting here today with the job that I have, the education that I have, the experience that I have, because I made that amends. An amends that I did not believe that I owed, because I thought if you were stupid enough to do that job, then you deserve what you got. Now I'm a drug and alcohol counselor, and I get way worse than any teachers ever get. You know? And I laugh because I bet you $50 my patients go, if you're stupid enough to do that job, you deserve what you got. And that's, so when we talk about amends and what I'd like to talk about tomorrow in terms of amends, what I'd like to talk about in terms of 10, 11, and 12 and some guided meditation that I'd like to do in the morning, I'd like you to tell me a story about that. I told you my amends stories. I told you about my mother. I told you about that moment of healing where she actually apologized to me for the things that happened in my life. And the pain of 20 years of pain melted away. I told you about this amends. I told you about knocking on the doors. I told you about going back to the stores and paying back the money. I told you about learning to hold my head up high. I told you about the amends I made, or the first approach I made in the airport in Charlotte. But I want to hear your stories, because my stories are great and they're my amends stories, but I bet you $50 you got better ones than I got. So I want y'all to think about what you can come up with in the morning. Don't make it up. I'll know if you're lying. Well, let's share a little bit about that and a little bit about that, because we forget. We think about amends, we think about that humiliation and that trudging. But there's so much freedom that comes with it. So I'd like you to come up with some of that stuff for in the morning, and then we'll kind of move along.